This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. Coal-fired power plants have taken the spotlight lately, but a new solar project planned for eastern North Carolina may signal a turn toward a cleaner, renewable energy source. When completed, it will be the largest photovoltaic project east of the Mississippi. North Carolina-based Duke Energy Renewables announced this week they will oversee development, construction, and operation of three photovoltaic sites in the northeastern part of the state. Solar power would be collected here and sent through the electrical grid to Washington, D.C., to George Washington University, American University, and George Washington University Hospital. The universities announced a multi-year agreement to buy more than 50% of their power from Duke Energy Renewables. Tammy McGee with Duke Energy Media Relations says the first phase of the solar panel project will be constructed in Pasquotank County near Elizabeth City and will be completed by the end of this year.
It'll be 20 megawatts of the 52 that the universities and hospital ultimately want. The remaining project sites will be probably, we're looking at a little west and north of Pasquotank County. These sites aren't locked down yet, so it may be one or two more sites in that general vicinity.
Duke Energy plans on building another 20 megawatt and a 12 megawatt site in North Carolina. Both are expected to be operational and developing power by the end of 2015. In total, the Capital Partner Solar Project will utilize 243,000 solar panels. The project is aimed at providing cost-effective and renewable power to large organizations in an urban setting. Director of George Washington University's Office of Sustainability, Megan Chappell, says the project started 4 years ago when the university started exploring ways to reduce their carbon footprint.
Because we're right in the heart of Washington, D.C., our roof space is pretty limited, and in plastering, painting it with solar panels will only get us to a percentage of what we need to reduce to become carbon neutral.
The university's goal is to be carbon neutral by the year 2040. Chappell says they reached out to George Washington University's hospital and nearby American University, who were also interested in the project. She says they put out requests for bid and received 28 bids from renewable energy providers.
Consultants really helped us think through the benefits of solar, and if we could site the solar energy east of the congestion of our grid, there would be some financial benefits we could see to make it more affordable and viable for us from an economic standpoint.
The two universities and hospital announced the solar energy plan that will supply 123 million kilowatt hours of solar power per year. That's the same amount of electricity to power 8,200 homes each year in Washington, D.C. Both universities entered into a 20-year agreement that will provide fixed pricing for solar energy at a cost that's less expensive than what the universities pay now for conventional power produced by coal and gas.
We anticipate that over the next 20 years, which is the duration of this contract, that power prices will likely increase, and that locking in a rate today that's relatively low will provide us with significant cost avoidance down the road.
Chappell says the partnership with Charlotte-based Duke Energy will provide carbon-free power to 50% of George Washington University.
We have a goal to reduce our carbon footprint by 40% by 2025 and 100% by 2040. And this really accelerates our goal. This is going to get us 30% of the way there.
American University will also source half of their electricity from renewable power. They're on track to be carbon neutral by the year 2020. When all three sites go online and 52 megawatts of solar power is being generated, McGee says a total of 60,000 metric tons of carbon dioxide will be eliminated annually.
So that's the equivalent of taking roughly 12,500 cars off the road or driving 140 million miles.
In addition to the environmental benefits, the project should also stimulate the local economy in northeastern North Carolina.
It will generate hundreds of construction jobs. Of course, the landowners benefit by getting the lease payments. It increases the tax base, and our construction and EPC provider always buys his equipment locally, you know, stays in the area hotels, eats at the area restaurants.
Later this year, around the time the first solar panel site near Elizabeth City breaks ground, the location of the two other sites are expected to be revealed. Duke Energy Renewables has built other photovoltaic sites in eastern North Carolina, including the Washington White Post project, built in 2012. That site in Beaufort County consists of 53,000 solar modules that can generate electricity for 3,000 homes. The company is nearing completion of solar sites in Bertie, Halifax, and Pitt counties. What started as a Texas observance of the news that slaves have been freed is now commonly referred to as Juneteenth, an observance of freedom for all. Today, Mac McKee speaks with Earl Imes, a curator with the North Carolina Museum of History, about the story of Juneteenth and current state tour of the 13th Amendment.
Juneteenth is a celebration of the date June 19th, the day that many African Americans observe as when the last of the enslaved in 1865 learned that they were free. Mr. Imes, how was the first Juneteenth celebrated about 150 years ago? I'm sure that the ideas even started a year or two before that, if I'm not mistaken.
Juneteenth is a Texas-specific event beginning about 149 years ago this month. And let's take specifically here in North Carolina, where the major events are winding down, Fort Fisher, the Battle of Bentonville, and of course the largest surrender of Confederate troops is at Bennett Place. 79,000 troops at Bennett Place surrendered in late April of 1865. In our state, the war had come to a military end because of the military strategy, particularly the Anaconda strategy employed by the Union Army and General Grant, where they came down the Mississippi River and from Mississippi east pretty much constricted the Confederacy. Well, that left Texas on the other side, which was relegated to many skirmishes. Naturally, when the surrender of the Confederate troops take place at Bennett Place, west of what's now Durham, the news of the war, of the surrender, had not reached Texas.
Now, as I understand it, after the surrender of Confederate forces in North Carolina, a constitutional convention to readmit the state to the Union specified that U.S. colored troops had to be removed from the state. They were sent to Texas.
Primarily in what's called the Piney Woods of East Texas, where the plantation economy really had taken place out there. And so literally, county by county, plantation by plantation, they're spreading the news of the Emancipation Proclamation until their commissions expire in June of 1866. So this is a process by which folks out in the western part of the former Confederacy are receiving news of the Emancipation Proclamation and freeing not only our enslaved ancestors from the scourge of slavery, but they freed our entire society. What becomes Juneteenth is the liberating news of the Emancipation Proclamation over really about a year's time, starting in the summer of 1865.
Considering that the Emancipation Proclamation was delivered in 1863, it's a testament to how long it took communications to travel.
Those 3 years is what we convey in our exhibit, and this particular Juneteenth tour is that our freedom is more of a process and less of a proclamation.
It's not just dealing, as you're saying, just with the African-American side of it.
The 13th Amendment makes no mention of African-Americans per se. It's the process by which we, and I say we collectively as Americans, our enslaved ancestors, our white ancestors, our Indian ancestors, are all freeing ourselves from the legal binding laws and customs of slavery. Here in North Carolina, South Carolina, slavery started with the establishment of the Carolina Charter in 1663. So by 1863, we had 200 solid years of slavery, and the customs were undergirding and enforcing slavery. Whites were bound to uphold and protect the slave codes, and there were sanctions against whites, usually flogging 39 lashes at the courthouse square.
So what you're saying, in effect, just how like North Carolina had to ratify the Constitution
right.
In 1789 originally.
We had to ratify it again coming back into the Union.
For readmission.
The 13th Amendment and the 14th Amendment to be readmitted to the Union.
Tomorrow, the Juneteenth tour stops in New Bern, where North Carolina's copy of the 13th Amendment will be on display at Tryon Palace's History Center. The event begins at 11 and ends at 5. Now, for folks interested in what's going on, what else can we expect to learn through this exhibit?
In addition to the document itself, we have also exhibited some slave-related artifacts, like some shackles and a brogan that was made for an enslaved hireling or an enslaved person who was hired out in Johnston County, in this case, between 1863 and 65, and possibly could have been hired into the Confederate Army. So those two artifacts have been traveling, and they'll be with us again. And Private Luke Martin was a freedom seeker who left his plantation outside of Plymouth, North Carolina, in Washington County, and literally swam three rivers during the winter of 1863 to get to New Bern so that he could enroll into the colored troops, into the U.S. colored troops. And he did so. He served his three-year commission, and after 1866, he remained in New Bern, helped to found a church. He was a Mason and a pastor. And in 1917, at age 80, Private Luke Martin, or at this time he was Pastor Luke Martin, had fathered a son, Luke Martin Jr., and Luke Martin Jr. will be 97 years young July 11th of this year. Mr. Luke Martin Jr. actually loaned us his father's 1861 Springfield Federal issue rifle. He also loaned us a Confederate sword that we think he may have captured on the battlefield. And we do know that he was at the only known battle in Florida, the Battle of Alusty, Florida, which was February 20, 1864.
Now, there's been some talk of Mr. Luke Martin Jr. attending the Tryon Palace event this weekend. I'm sure lots of folks will be looking forward to perhaps meeting with him. Now, I know this tour is wrapping up with the Tryon Palace venue in New Bern, but if we want to learn more about our Civil War history and North Carolina's copy of the 13th Amendment, where can we go?
Folks can get more information by going on to the North Carolina Department of Cultural Resources website at ncculture.com.
Well, Mr. Adams, thank you so much for being with us today.
Okay, very much. Thank you very much for having me.
The 13th Amendment is only on loan for a short time, this tour being the first time it's left Raleigh in 149 years. Tomorrow, you can see the document and related artifacts at Tryon Palace's History Center in New Bern.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. It's about that time of year to harvest garlic, and garlic has become my absolute most favorite garden vegetable, believe it or not, partially because I use so much garlic at home. And growing my own means when I reach for a clove of garlic, I smile knowing that I grew it in my own garden. Here in North Carolina, you grow garlic as a winter annual by planting individual cloves somewhere between late September and early November. You want to make sure you have a good root system before a really cold winter sets in. And then the garlic plant has that wonderful opportunity for 2 months at temperatures between 32 and 50. That's what initiates bulbing. And then warm temperatures in late spring really stimulates the full bulb growth. So it's really an easy process. Plant individual garlic cloves, 1 to 2 inches deep and 2 to 6 inches apart in rows, usually in late September through mid-October, but you can go as late October some years. The plants will come up pretty quickly and stay fairly small through the winter. When they start growing again in the spring, give them a little more nitrogen and make sure there's plenty of soil moisture throughout the growing season without being too wet. It's time to harvest garlic when the leaf tops begin to discolor and dry. Garlic is ready for harvest when the cloves are fully segmented, but the bulb is still tightly encased by an intact outer skin. You might want to pull one bulb up to check before harvest. Then loosen the soil around the bulbs and pull the bulbs individually by hand, being careful not to bruise them. Garlic needs to be cured for several weeks after harvest and before storage. place the bulbs in some sort of slotted bins or baskets in a covered but open area where plenty of air can circulate. If you only have a few bulbs, you can hang them from rafters. Once you've finished curing for a few weeks, discard any that are diseased or clearly damaged. Gently clean the remaining ones by brushing off the dirt and trim off the tops and the roots. You can then store your garlic in open mesh sacks in a dry, well-ventilated storage room, or braid them and store them that way. I'm going to check my garlic tonight to see if it's ready to harvest and start the curing process. And I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.
The comeback continues for the Cleveland County-based band The Acoustic Syndicate. They hadn't been in the studio since 2004 and hadn't regularly toured in over nearly a decade, but they also never quite got all the way out with occasional shows here and there over the last several years. But about a year back, they decided to give it one more shot. New tour, new CD, and are again willing to consider the bright lights with the knowledge they can always contentedly return to the farm. George Olson has this, which originally aired in October 2013.
The roots of the band, The Acoustic Syndicate, are certainly deep. The three McMurrays who front the band, two brothers, one cousin, are fifth-generation Cleveland Countyers.
Cleveland County is, of course, the home of Earl Scruggs. He actually worked in the same cotton mill with my grandmother. They worked in the same mill when they were children.
Those five generations have farmed the same piece of land since the 1700s. In more modern times, immigrant labor came in to help work the farm.
I guess one of the biggest eye-opening experiences for me musically was we were vegetable farmers, and we had a group of immigrant workers from Haiti and Jamaica come and visit our and work for us on our farm. They brought Jimmy Cliff and Bob Marley and some ska, and I'd never heard this kind of music before in my life, and it made me realize that there was a bigger world out there musically.
So somewhere between Scruggs and ska, that's where you'll find the music of Acoustic Syndicate.
What if the rain starts to fall? What can we do about it? Should we do anything at all? We could ride on through.
The Acoustic Syndicate is enjoying a revival these days. They've been together for 20 years, but in 2004 they were ready to call it quits. They'd shared the stage with such notables as Little Feat and Leftover Salmon, had performed for thousands of fans, and were recording for the well-respected mid-major record label Sugar Hill. But they still were working the family farm plus starting families, and those responsibilities were pulling them back home. So in 2004, as Brian McMurray says, they did what he thought was their final gig.
We did one last run out to Colorado in the western states, and we came home and ended it with a big show in this festival, local festival called Smile Fest, and we played every song we knew that night and stopped at 5 a.m. We thought, I literally walked off the stage into my car, drove an hour home when the sun was coming up. I had a greenhouse full of tomatoes I was growing, 1,200 tomato plants growing in my greenhouses, and I literally went right back to farming, and I thought Acoustic Syndicate was over.
But they never quite got out. They kept their booking agent, and every so often a call would come in for a good money gig, so off the band would go. But if the live performances never quite came to an end, the recording seemed to. They did their last Sugar Hill project in 2004, and then nothing, until the band picked up one of their occasional gigs, this time in Montana, and with travel time came time to talk with Cousin Steve.
I'd had some songs dancing and melodies dancing around. It's a blessing and a curse when you're trying to think about other things. You have stuff coming to you. So we've got these songs dancing around. Steve, who had historically been the primary songwriter of the band, but he and I did shared much of the songwriting, and more so him. I just had these songs that were there, and so over the course of us sitting in Missoula, Montana, hit some Steve and myself. We said, let's make another record and just see what happens.
Catching sand from the outlines. Funny how it slips away.
What happened was the new CD, Rooftop Garden. Lyrically, it sounds a lot like Acoustic Syndicate used to. Brian says they always sung about the environment, sustainable farming, hypocrisy, the things they found wrong with the world. But texturally, it's a bit different, with the horns that had marked their sound over their first five CDs, giving way to a new instrument brought to them courtesy of the band's bassist Jay Sanders that seemed tailor-made for Acoustic Syndicate's ska to scrug sound.
Jay had introduced us. I'd always kind of known who he was. This gentleman, his name is Billy Cardine, that plays resophonic guitar in dobro. He's yet another musical virtuoso. He studied a lot of Indian slide, and his whole approach to the instrument is not from a traditional bluegrass. The songs we were writing were a little more, I'll say, acoustic rock and roll kind of, and he brings an edgier sound with his instrument. So it is a departure to some degree from what we had left off, but yet some of the songwriting and some of the lyrical content kind of remains consistent with what we've been kind of writing all along.
That consistency coming right off the bat with Rooftop Garden's title track. It's not an anti-government screed. It's not a pro-government anthem. It lies somewhere in between.
It's just kind of my take on somewhat of a disconnect that folks have and the misconception. Some of it's true and some of it's misconception of how government is in our daily lives. Yes, there is corrupt government. Yes, there is bad government. But that song kind of summarizes. Let's see what happens if you take all government out and give free reins to 0.5% of the population of this country. And I think you would see corruption on a lot more massive scale. The Rooftop Garden being the government and we the people being the roots that can keep it connected to the ground.
No one walks away.
But the music of Acoustic Syndicate hasn't yet gotten preserved in amber. 20 years passing brings change, whether wanted or not.
As they get older, you start realizing all kinds of things, the finiteness of it all. I think that's just the way it happens.
Brian says he sometimes feels they're becoming sappy old men. You're not getting sappy, Brian. You're attaining wisdom. At least that's what us old men say. Evidence of that wisdom, Brian's song Heroes for his parents.
My mother, just out of left field, she's had a couple bouts with cancer, one particular big bout with cancer, and she's doing very, very well. She's so far a success story of just kind of came out of left field, and so that was just kind of a song of thanks to her and to my dad. But what I admire about him, he's truly done something that he absolutely loves. And through the lean years, he's farmed. That's all he started when he graduated high school. He bought this land that we live on. He's 19 from my uncle. Very few people can say that. They've done one career and absolutely loved every day, even through the hard times.
To be there to listen and to love.
Might be pushing the wisdom comes with age thing out of self-interest. Seems like Brian's doing okay for himself in that regard, and has been for a while. The band is big on sharing its music. Yes, they're still trying to sell tickets and CDs, but go to their website and download a free concert recording, or show up at a show and record one yourself. As Brian told me, there's much more to be said about good karma than bad karma.
We don't have any grand expectations of having thousands of people come out to see us anymore. But we still have people that will come and still come and record shows. They set up live, and they're still getting the word out. You know, after we're dead and gone, these songs may find their way to somebody and make them smile a little or bring a little joy to them in their days, hopefully. Best way I can sum that up, I guess.
The time is now before we lost forever. Easy, the thought it goes so much to learn. We got to remember.
Brian McMurray of Cleveland County's The Acoustic Syndicate. Their new CD is Rooftop Garden. I'm George Olson.
Live and be happy.
The Down East Journal is made possible by our Public Radio East members in partnership with Vidant Health, featuring cancer care navigators, specialists trained to answer questions and coordinate cancer care. Learn more online at vidanthealth.com/navigator. Don't forget, you can help Public Radio East pick the new theme song for Down East Journal. Go to our website, publicradioeast.org, where you can hear all three submissions and vote for your favorite.